ideas, inspiration, innovation. This is The Game Changer. And now here's your host, Chickie Fitzgerald.
Good afternoon. This is Chickie Fitzgerald with the Game Changer Network, and we have got a real treat for you today. Actually, it's a treat for me because we have got a show all about entrepreneurialism. And the name of the book we're going to be talking about today is The Startup J-Curve. And our author guest today is Howard Love. Howard, welcome.
Thanks, Chickie. I'm excited to be here, and thanks for having me.
Oh, well, as I said, it's a real treat for me because I found out at actually a fairly late stage in life that I was born to be an entrepreneur. And so it's been an awesome journey, but I am really, really interested in hearing about the 6 steps to entrepreneurial success so that I can do a little bit of course correction on my current venture. And before we dive into the book, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to actually write this book?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was lucky to discover I was an entrepreneur at an early age, and one of the ways you discover that is you struggle to work for others. I definitely did. Always have. So I'm not particularly proud of it. It's like an affliction, you know. But I never really had the ability to go out and kind of get into just a normal job, despite my dear mother, you know, frequently referring, you know, talking to me after college and says, you know, in the sort of when are you going to get a real job conversation,
right.
Which actually never really happened. But I started a company or two while I was at Colgate, which is where I went to college. And because I wasn't terribly into college either, really, the truth is. Partner and I started a company or two. We technically started 2 companies, but one emerged from that. And I've been starting companies ever since and have founded or co-founded about 15 companies and invested in another 50 or 60, and I've always been an entrepreneur, and I have the dubious claim to fame that I've never really had a real job.
Well, it took me a little while longer than you to figure that out. I spent a good 15 to 20 years in corporate life, but the good news about that is I got to be an intrapreneur, buying companies with other people's money when I still had a salary. But I got to go through all the same things of pitching it internally. And I don't know if you know Bob Crandall, who was the
American
CEO
Airlines.
Of American Airlines.
Of course.
Well, Bob was the first one that I borrowed $5 million from to do a venture within the Sabre organization, which is where I spent my...
He was a tough guy. You must have been pretty good at pitching him.
Oh, my gosh. And, you know, I was in my early 30s or maybe even my late 20s. And, it was a real lesson in communication, really.
Yeah. And his particular form of communication, as I recall, was quite direct and blunt.
Oh, yes. In fact, after we acquired the company, about a year later, he came over to get an update on it, and we showed him a demo, and he told me that the product was as user-friendly as a scorpion. And I guess I didn't know enough of how horrified I should have been. But it was another 2 years later, and we had taken our product into Unisys, Sun Microsystems, and Digital Equipment. It happened to be a Unix-based expense reporting platform.
Okay.
And it was very interesting because, you know, we were just getting ready to launch in these 3 major companies, but the company within the company, of course, had not made any money yet. And he saw it on a list of projects in a big staff meeting with about 40 people, and he said, "Is that still around? Shut that down." And then he went on to the next item on the agenda, and I didn't even get to say a word. And later after the meeting, he came up and he said, "Hey, if we thought you were doing a bad job, we would have gotten rid of you. But, you know, we just got rid of the business." So that was my a baptism into entrepreneurialism.
Yeah. It's You know, there's actually a number of advantages to sort of starting out your, you know, feeling out your entrepreneurial roots and getting started inside a company, because it, you said kind of the key issue, which is you get to do it kind of on someone else's dime. And,
yes.
You know, being an entrepreneur is so tough on your own. So to be able to do it within a corporation is quite a blessing, and it's great to get that experience.
Well, it is. And it gave us really a lot more runway than if we had raised the money from a VC or, you know, any number of the other ways that you can do that.
And
well,
also have all those resources within a company.
Yes.
And then you develop all, you know, all sorts of contacts. So, I'm very optimistic for folks who have worked inside companies and, you know, want to strike it out and on their own and try their own thing, because there's actually a number of advantages that, you know, that you can have by doing that.
Well, and the other interesting thing, Howard, is I stepped out of corporate life 20 years ago, but I spent the first half of that 20 years doing strategic consulting. So I was actually on the services side of being in my own business, and I really don't consider that having an entrepreneurial business or having to apply the kinds of principles that you're talking about in the Startup J-Curve, because if you don't have assets, or you're not having to invest, whether it be in technology or goods, and you know have a staff, it's very, very different. And so I really realized that it was 10 years ago when I raised my first external capital and built my first technology company that's when I became an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
So tell us about the six steps and how this came about as a methodology that I'm presuming you use now as a metric and a measurement in the companies that you do invest in.
Yeah, I mean, they came about first, you know, the first thing that really came about was just the shape of what happens, and we ultimately referred to that as a J-curve. And so most entrepreneurs, almost all of them start, and particularly the first-time ones and even the second or third, they think that the world operates, that their startup is going to sort of, if you can imagine a straight line, it's going to start at the beginning, and that's point A, and then just overly simplify it, point B is the success point, and that's just like a straight line up and to the right. And what we realized and discussions with my venture partner, David Heeman, who I've been investing with and creating companies with for 20 plus years, is that all these companies that we've been associated with, and this includes almost all the successful companies that we've invested with and or co-founded, you start off at this point and it's sort of wonderful, and you have this idea and you create this PowerPoint deck and you talk to friends about it, and it's quite euphoric, actually, right there at the sort of very beginning, right? I mean, everything's great. You don't have any problems because it's just a PowerPoint deck. You know, there's no particular reality attached to it. And and then you realize that things, as you sort of actually start down the path, that life is a little tougher than you sort of imagined. You know, it's a little tougher to get the team members together, maybe, or maybe some of the team members aren't quite what you thought. It's always tougher to raise money than you think, and it always takes longer to actually create a product than you had in the PowerPoint deck. And so I call that, and so you're sort of, you know, you're dipping down. And I call that first phase create. The second phase is called release, and that's when you try and get the product out there. And of course, there's all sorts of challenges associated with actually releasing a product. And then usually, what happens after you release it is precisely nothing. Nobody really cares, and the first product almost never works. And so, if you can imagine what we're sort of tracing down is this sort of dip in the J, right?
Right.
And the bottom of the J is kind of around there. It's kind of post release, where you have essentially crickets. You know, nobody cares the product doesn't sell, it doesn't work, and so, you know, you're sitting there in a pretty precarious situation. From that point, you can kind of, you know, go out of business and stick with it and be pigheaded and stubborn and everything else, or you can be flexible and creative and move into the next phase, which is what I call morph. And morph is
right.
Where you take a little bit of glimmer of hope that there's almost always there from that initial product release, and you say, well, what if we did more of that, and what if we did less of the things that we thought would be neat but actually nobody cares about? And so you go through that process of doing iterations, and you become something other than what was in the original business plan. And that's the morph stage. And now we're heading up a little bit, because now you're actually starting to make real progress. And then after you figure out the product and you have sort of this product market fit and you're getting substantial customer traction, then you go into the fourth phase, which is what I call model. And model's just exactly what it says. It's where you're trying to figure out the business model. So once you actually know what the product is, then you need to figure out how to make money.
Right.
And what the whole business model is going to be. And now we're starting to accelerate up the sort of right-hand part of any J-curve, and you move into scale. So once you figure out the product and the business model, it's time to blow it out, get it out into the world, scale it up, scale up revenues, and scale up your sales and marketing, get it out into the world. And that's the phase I call scale.
Right.
And then after scale, when you've really kind of blown the product out, you move into what I call harvest phase. And harvest is sort of where we all want to end up in a business, which is where the business is profitable, it's throwing off cash, you're firmly established, and you can start to do things like, you know, say, what do I do with all this cash I'm making?
Right.
And you can distribute dividends, you can do stock buybacks, you can IPO, you can actually, it's a good time to sell the company if you're interested in doing that. Or if better yet, you stick around, you use the cash for investments in brand or new products or new product extensions or acquisitions and just all sorts of fun stuff. So
right, right.
That composite creates what I call the J-curve. And then going back to the beginning of my comments, here is you can see how different that is from the expectation that it goes in a straight line up and to the right. And that's really the purpose of the book, you know, called The Startup J-Curve.
Well, and it's reality. I mean, this is reality. And you know, the interesting thing is in my last couple of businesses, I had about 8 years ago we raised $7 million to build a technology that is still desperately needed in the travel industry.
Uh-huh.
And we built it, and we, you know, brought on the dream team. You know, I mean, we did all the things that sound like that straight line up,
mm-hmm.
right? Except for we fell off the edge of the earth when the product was positioned on a merchandising basis in a place where it never had any visibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were partnering with a company that at the time was the number two online travel company in the world. And we thought, you know, we can't lose. We've got four places we're positioned on their site. Well, they forgot to tell us that we were going to be in rotating ad space instead of having our own persistent placement, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we pretty quickly, you know, fell down on that business model place. And so, you know, you have to go back. And then, you know, in many cases, you do start again, and you go back to that morph stage, and embracing radical change is something that, I certainly have done many times in my career. But yeah. I want to get back to the beginning of the book, because and thank you so much for walking through those six steps, because I think it's really important to have that as a foundation for the overall discussion.
Yeah.
So the value of a map is your very first chapter of the book, and really laying out that roadmap and that plan of where it is that you're going. And I know you've met a lot of different kinds of entrepreneurs, and from the tech oriented person who maybe doesn't have some of the business sense to the business sense and the idea person who has no clue how to get something built.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us where that roadmap begins and when you're ready to actually move out of that create phase into the release phase.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're asking about the very, very early part. You have the genesis of an idea, and that idea phase is really, really kind of interesting. And gosh, you could probably write a whole book on that, but I did write at least a whole chapter on it. And there's a number of actually, I would say, sort of misconceptions about that idea phase. The first is, and a couple of very important ones. The first is that, let's just say, ideas either happen one or two ways. It either just hits you in the face, right? Or you say, well, I actually don't have an idea, but I want to sort of go do my own thing. And those
right.
are kind of two different things. And the second one is wildly overlooked because I think there's this misconception that the great ideas and the great companies that have been built, the founder just had some sort of a moment of genius where he was communicating with God and God told him, go forth and build Facebook.
Right.
It just doesn't work that way. What happens is people do have ideas, but they're, and we've all had sort of inspirations like this would be really cool or whatever. And that's great. And that can happen. The first thing to do is to go socialize that idea and see if any of your friends or family or people that are close to you think it's an equally good idea. And that's sort of one way. We'll call that the sort of hits you in the face in the middle of the night. The other is kind of in a way more interesting, is that. And we have done this quite regularly, where we actually, we meaning my venture partner David Heeman and I, we actually identify the person that we want to go into business with.
Right.
And we actually don't have an idea. And often the person's baffled when we approach them and they're like, well, what are we going to do? And we're like, we don't know, but we'll figure it out. And we'll figure it out. And the point is, and there are ways to figure it out. And I go through in the book sort of a process of there's different types of ideas, and this is
right.
How you get your head in the right place to start looking for opportunities. And here's when you might notice one, and so forth. But the real point is that from our perspective, having done this for 20 plus years, is we realize that the initial idea almost never works anyway. So there's this misconception that the initial idea is like the big thing, right? And that everything else is, whatever. They went out and executed it. It's really the inverse. The initial idea almost never works. So, David and I, we don't put a whole bunch of stock in it necessarily. It's
right.
like, let's think it through by all means, and let's be excited about it by all means, and let's have that idea be in a field that the entrepreneur and to a lesser degree us have real passion for. Because in the end, what matters is the person, the founder, and their commitment to the process. We don't necessarily want them committed to the initial idea, the product. We want
right.
them committed to the enterprise. We want them committed to the undertaking. And to some degree, we want them committed to whatever the bigger mission statement is. But specifically what the product is going to be, we don't, it's not the critical thing, because the critical thing is the individual who's going to go through the process of creating a successful company. So it's really interesting, that's what we've seen. Just sort of as an interesting metric Just for fun, you know, David and I, and I've talked to lots of other venture capitalists about this, like, well, you know, if you had to put a value on the initial idea, what kind of value would you put on it? And I think if you ask that question to most people, they'd say, well, 50% or, you know, I don't know, some very big number, 60, 70% or whatever. Our take is the initial idea, and this is only if it's a really, really good one, where we look at it and say, wow, that seems like a really, really good idea. Our take is about 5% of the company. That's all it's worth, you know? And so if you embrace that up front, that the initial idea is, you know, it's terribly interesting, and I'm not saying it's not important, but it's the process that matters, because, you know, your average startup is a 10 to 15-year undertaking. That's a long time. And so if you look at it that way, what's really going to matter is the people involved and commitment to the process and you know, ensuring the long-term success.
Right. Well, it's so interesting. Well, a lot of what you have said, you know, I've encountered each of those situations, and lately I've been hanging around a lot on a site called Founder Dating, which is a very interesting place to be, because exactly what you described occurs there. You've got people who have ideas, some of whom have taken it all the way through building their minimum viable product and self-funding, which is the place where I am in my current business.
Yep.
And then there are others who want to get on the bandwagon of somebody who's already got that momentum, you know, but in both cases, you know, neither one is actually bringing money to the table, which, you know, you talk in chapter two where you're really honing in on this create phase, that you have to temper those dreams with ideas, yes, money, structure, and teams. And if you only have two of those, or if you only, you know, or you're missing the teams and you've been able to accomplish everything else, which is actually, you know, again, the place where I find myself, is I've gotten everything moved along just as far as I possibly can.
Okay.
But then how do you attract the teams? And so, you know, it's really, really interesting to me that you talk about tempering the dreams. And so it's almost like you need to be running, but you've got to slow down in order to be able to get to that place where you can actually release a product.
Yeah. You know, the startup journey is a long journey. And I like to say it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Right.
And, you know, I know there's this current infatuation with sprints, and we're going to sprint here, and we're doing a development sprint, and we're doing a marketing sprint. Right now, I'm not a huge favor, actually. What is going to win the day from my perspective is a very steady application of, yes, very hard work and everything else, but it's people kind of keeping their heads and taking everything in stride and perspective and realizing that this takes a very long time. Just the dip of the J curve, and it's funny when I explained the J curve, and I didn't necessarily see this coming, but you know, I was down in Austin, for example, and I was giving this talk in front of about 60 entrepreneurs down there. And, you know, all the hands went up right after the talk. It's like, they want to know how long is the dip of the J curve, right? How long is the tough part? Which and that dip I refer to as the long, cold winter.
Yeah, how long can you tread water?
Yeah, they're like, wow, okay. Well, they know. The interesting thing is they intuitively get it. And they love the discussion, because not many people have really actually told them that this is what's going on.
Right.
In fact, very few. Or they may have gotten bits and pieces, but no one's ever really laid it out for them like that. And they get it. They know damn well it's not. I mean, they've figured out if they're into their startup for any length of time, they know damn well it's not a straight line.
Right.
So that long, cold winter valley of death takes. It's incredibly rare that it happens in 2 years. It's more like kind of 2.5, sort of 3 to 5 years, and it can take longer. It can take 6 or 7.
I'm encouraged by that, Howard, because as I mentioned in my previous venture, which was, you know, 6-7 years ago, We were able to move at a really fast pace because my partner and I had, you know, each put in $250,000, and then I ended up buying her out and brought in a local partner here in Tampa. And he was putting in money at a pretty quick clip. And so we were able to move really fast. But, you know, when you use the metaphor of running and the sprint versus the marathon, I mean, it's really apropos with all of us having been watching the Olympics for the last 2 weeks. You know, you watch that guy or that girl who, you know, comes off of the starting line really fast. But if it is a marathon, they very rarely are the ones who make it all the way to the end. And in that initial venture, yeah, we were able to run really, really fast. And you know, but when I say we raised $7 million, you know the answer. We needed 10, right? And 7 wasn't enough. But now I've made kind of the opposite end of the spectrum choice to self-fund, which means you go way, way slower, right? But now I feel that I am at that nice marathon clip where I can finish the race. And so I'm curious. Plays into that dream phase, because certainly if you're fortunate enough to be able to fuel your dreams and ideas with money, it's a different picture than if you're bootstrapping and you have to get the structure in place, the team, maybe. I haven't actually needed a team to get my product in place. We're already a year post-launch of the product. And now I have to figure out if I want to raise money or not, and I'm still not convinced that I do. So talk to me about tempering the dreams and where money plays into that equation.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked this, and I would say, you know, the first question I always get asked is, how long is that long, cold winter? And the second question I ask is types of questions are all money-related, and this is what I think. First of all, of the two startups you mentioned, I can tell you which one I'd rather invest in. And it's a no-brainer, except for me personally, but it's completely counterintuitive.
Right.
I would vastly prefer your current business to the first one. If you came to me and said, hey, we've raised, let's just say, I don't know, you were halfway through raising your $7 million. We've raised $3.5 million and blah, 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 and we got this, and we got the team spun up and this. I would just run for the hills. I don't like those, actually.
Right. And I can see that. I can see that.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about the current venture is we actually started 7 years ago with this current product in parallel with the other venture. I did this one on the side. And we went through the create, release, morph, and put on the shelf. I mean, that's not one of your steps. But, you know, you talked.
No, I didn't have to put on the shelf.
No, but it
happens.
You talked about abandoning, right, and shutting the company down.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate because my day job was still being a strategic consultant. So I could go on doing that, put it on the shelf, and then pull it off when it was appropriate, dust it off, and completely morph it.
I call that hibernation,
mm-hmm.
and that
yes.
is a valid strategy, actually. And I've done that before, and it's worked out okay. Yeah,
right.
The hibernation is interesting. Let me go. I want to go back because you asked such an important question, and I don't feel I did it justice, which is the whole money question. You know, first of all, I want to make a couple of comments. You're bootstrapping, and I say God bless you. I freaking just love bootstrapping. I'm like addicted to bootstrapping. I love bootstrapping.
I'm the maven of bootstrapping.
I love it. I love it, love it, love it, because – and there's nothing wrong with raising money. I mean, I've been associated with some companies that it just, you know, their business model definitely calls for raising money. There's no question about it. And I'm signed up for that. If that's really what it is, then fine, let's go do it. But I definitely have, you know, a real love of bootstrapping, and I have bootstrapped a number of businesses myself, and I just love to see it. And there's several reasons for that. Number one, it forces discipline. I make the point in the book that, and I've just seen this, and this is just totally counterintuitive, but from what I've seen, it's equally dangerous to have too much money as it is to have too little. And
yes.
I would even argue it's more dangerous to have too much money than too little. The problem with too much money is it encourages it encourages it creates an environment where you can lack discipline. And in a startup, you always have more to do than you have resources for.
Right.
And the problem is, if you have too much money, you might just go do those things, and they're often ill-advised. And
right.
So when you have too little money, you spend a lot of time sitting around thinking, like, well, given my extreme lack of resources, I need to think long and hard about precisely where I'm putting those resources.
Right.
And that kind of financial, you know, discipline, which also translates into product discipline and simplicity, are just wonderful, wonderful traits to build a business on.
Yes,
and
actually that is, and I'll use a kind of a different term from the running metaphor, it's the throttle.
Sure.
That helps you to pace.
Yeah.
Right? Because, and again, in that first venture that I described, the other big mistake, and I mean, these guys were all wonderful people, but
yeah.
I recruited for that dream team the former head of AOL Travel, the former head of EDS Travel and Transportation, and the former head of marketing for AAA. We were building a road trip tool. And, you know, here I thought I had just hit the home run. But the problem is, when you've got people who have zero entrepreneurial experience and all they've had is that corporate paycheck and the admin who does the stuff for
big
you.
Big problem, yeah.
Yeah, and you can buy an airline ticket anytime you want, then
well,
that's what you
yeah.
do.
And here's what I say, and I hope you don't mind if I use your example as a little bit of a what not to do example.
Oh, not at all. I mean,
okay.
that was the subject of my first book, Bootstrap Business.
Okay. All right, good. Good, because I definitely address this in the book. There are, okay, during the early part of the company, you know, which is, you know, as I say, that long, cold winter, and that's where really, frankly, the really, 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 really tough work is done. And I'm not saying that scale and harvest don't have the challenges, but it's really it's the create, release, morph, and model, and of course, the toughest is the morph, where you're really trying to figure out what on earth the product is and how
right.
this thing's gonna actually fly. And when you're going through the dip and the J, the long cold winter, you do not want a big team. Number one, why? Because it's just too hard to sort of, you know, it's too hard to make sharp turns. And
right.
sharp turns are a requirement, and that flexibility and that sort of malleability and the creativity is very, very tough if you have big teams, number one. Number two, I make the point in the book, and I really focus on this in the scale chapter, that there are kind of two types of people that make successful startups in the long term. And while you're going through the first four phases, the type of person you need is very, very different than
yes.
the type of person you need when you get into scale. And
absolutely.
I could reverse that and say the type of people you need in scale are totally different than the founding team. And so in the founding team, you need generalists, and you need sort of people who can wear many hats, and you need creativity, and you need everyone's input on everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you're really, really a tight, tight, you know, team. And everyone's doing everything. Everyone's helping everyone else out. And it's fun, right? I mean, it's cool. It's a small, flexible, quick team. It's like a, you know, quick reactionary force, right? Or it's like a SEAL team or whatever, right?
Right.
There's just a handful, and they can do a hell of a lot. And then, but once, and by the way, the corporate types just don't work in that environment. Usually,
no.
I mean, I don't want to count them out. I'm just saying it's very, very different, and than having this sort of environment where you have, you know, resources and you specialize and you got your admin, and it just doesn't work. When you
right.
typically, like I said, look, I'm not condemning. I'm not counting them out. I'm just saying that if people with those types of background want to get in and do that, they have to realize it's a very different animal, and you know, right? And that's okay. Now,
when
you get out of the J, right, and you're emerging and you figured out the product and the model, and you're moving into scale, guess what? You absolutely need those people, right?
Right.
I mean, that's
right.
When you got to bring those people in to have exactly what you just sort of referred to, which is these people have very impressive sounding resumes.
Yes.
They probably went to great schools. They probably got good grades, certainly far better than me. They have experience. And
right.
Most importantly, they are specialists, right? So you get like the CFO, and you know what? He's an accounting maven, and he's freaking awesome at it. And he's going to put in place the process, people, and money, to make the scale. And you've got a salesperson, and the salesperson is an ex-Oracle guy, and he's, you know, or gal, and they are killer at it, and they're incredibly good.
Right.
They know how to do what they do. And it's really, you know, you think you get to scale and you're like, oh, this is awesome. Like, you know, now we're like really going to take off and have a lot of fun. But it's actually one of the most gut-wrenching times, because you have
yes.
to make this transition of the people. And the founding team,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's quite often that members of the founding team simply are unable to make that transition. Because
right.
they're like, no, I want to go, you know, have my input on marketing, and I want to have my input on product, and I want to have my input on, you know,
right.
customer service. And you know what? Sorry, but you can't. You need to pick one of these silos and go do it. And you know what? If we want your opinion, we'll ask you for it. It's not that you can't communicate and stuff, but like, you need to be a specialist. And the
right,
founding,
right.
this is where the founding team, you start hearing, you know, oh, hey, like, dude, we've totally lost our soul here. You know, we're doing all this, there's all this process, and there's all these meetings. And it's like, yeah, we'll freaking deal with it. It's a different deal, right? It's a different phase. And I think if people realize that up front, it'll kind of all become clear, and they can kind of choose what they want to do. And a lot of founders, members of the founding team, you know, they might say, look, it's just not for me, you know, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
Well, I laugh because just a few weeks ago, I got in touch with a guy who, again, very highly placed in a very big company name that everyone would know in the tech arena, and I saw that he had just left.
Yeah.
And so I reached out to him, and it's like, you know, hey, what are you up to? You know, because I'm at that place where I need to scale. And so he was asking me, I sent him my deck and we were talking through it, and he said, well, you know, where do you feel you need to go next? And I said, well, I think we just need some additional money to seed, you know, and begin to accelerate, but, you know, we still have a little bit of work to do, on this business model piece. And I wasn't using your terminology, but so then he starts talking about seed being $3 million.
Wow.
And I'm
yeah.
thinking, wait a minute.
No.
I mean, that would be like the first external round. That wouldn't be the seed.
Yeah.
But the more he talked, I mean, the more I started getting excited about kind of the context of why he was asking the question. But it's so funny, the orientation. And, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs do get sucked in by those big names and the resumes and the this and the that, right? Thinking that that's what's going to make them successful. So I'm glad you bring that up.
Yeah, and often I see just sort of the flip side is that they underestimate their own abilities, and they sometimes lack confidence or whatever. It's like, well, I don't have the big resume. I didn't go to Wharton and get my MBA and blah blah blah. But it none of those things really matter. What matters
right.
is your passion and commitment to what you're doing. And look, there, as I say, there's a place for those, you know, true professionals and those people with deep, you know, domain experience to come in. It's just, you know, they're a no-brainer in the scale phase. Like, you're desperate for those folks.
Right.
And if they come in earlier, you know, everyone just needs to understand up front kind of, you know, that it's a different animal.
Mm-hmm. I have a really important question, and this comes up every single day on the discussions that are happening on founder dating, because one of the hot commodities right now is the concept of having a technical co-founder. and mm-hmm. and you know, whether the model is giving them, you know, a big chunk of equity so that they're, you know, really vested in the success, or mm-hmm. You know, any iteration of that, whether it be revenue sharing or, you know, the things that you can do before you can afford to give market salaries. The mm-hmm. difference between taking that approach and, you know, as because I have not done that. I mean, I've been looking really, really hard, but I have not found that person or that company who could play that role. And I've got an advisor in my company that, you know, is just diametrically opposed to outsourcing of technology at all. And so I am wondering, from your experience and from your perspective, where nailing the technical resource, and you know, again, I speak as a fairly technical founder.
Yeah.
Not, you know, I can't roll up my sleeves and program, but I can take it all the way to that place. And so I've been able to get, you know, post minimum viable product, you know, without having to have somebody on the inside. But I'm ready for them now. I just can't find them, right? So what is your perspective on the role of the technical talent? Can a company be successful outsourcing its tech?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
I knew that was the answer, Howard. I just needed you to tell me.
You asked.
I asked. I got it.
But let me dive into it just a little bit, because it is a very common question and it's a very common occurrence. And obviously, I'm overstating the case, okay? For dramatic effect,
or not?
But let me just get into it. A couple of things. First of all, you know, on whether it's, first of all, it's better. Let's go way back at the very high level. The data shows that it is classically better to have two founders than one. Okay? Think Jobs Wozniak, think Dave Filo, Jerry Yang, think Larry Page, Sergey Brin.
Right.
Think you know, think Gates and Allen, right? At Microsoft. The list goes on and on and on and on and on, and it's just better, okay? And, you know, so that's just the data, and I would say that's the reality. Having said that, you know, you could argue that there's Jeff Bezos, right? And, you know, and if we spend longer, we could come up with a number of those. So I think solo acts are fine too. I'd love to know, for example, for me personally, I have amazing folks that I work with, and I certainly consider them partners. But ultimately, it was a bit of a solo act, and so you know, it's okay to be solo, but it just happens to be a bit better to have a founding partner, and ideally and classically, at least one of the two is sort of in charge of the technology.
Right.
Now, okay, so I just wanted to get that out there, and I talk about that in the book, because that's just kind of the data, and if you really think about it, you know, that's kind of what's happened, right? By the way, you could also an additional one to Bezos would be probably Mark Zuckerberg, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had perhaps more partners than history, you know, than the media mentions. But, you know, you'd have to give Mark credit. He's kind of done it more or less by himself. He's had certainly good people around him. But so you can go, you know, either way works. But founding partner is better than a solo act typically. But it's not
right.
a requirement. And I would say, for your particular situation and where you are, I think that, you look, it's fine, you know, you're doing the MVP and so forth, but I think that you want to bring in the technology, you know, as soon as you can.
Oh, no, without a doubt.
Yeah,
you don't have to
do it
person...
with a founder, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are things like Odesk, now called Upwork. There are, which I guess is in a way outsourcing, but so actually that would not be a good example. But it's okay to do that super early on. But at some point, you want to get someone who works for the company. It may even just be part-time, but you want to get them full-time fairly quickly,
right.
You know, as soon as sort of money allows. And the reason is, look, you want to own the technology inside. And it's when you, at some point, when you go out to investors, they're going to want to know, so, you know, who's the person that created this? And if you say, well, it's actually done by an outside shop, that is a bit of a wet blanket. I mean, you want to clearly have the technology inside and you want to own it. And here's the problem. When an investor hears that it's kind of all done on the outside, my immediate reaction is, well, okay, but all I know is when we find that CTO and or sub-CTO, maybe just a developer, and we go to bring it in-house, what's the first thing they're going to say? And they say it 100% of the time.
They're
going
to rebuild it.
What?
They're going to rebuild it.
Of course.
Of course they are.
100%.
You never go to get your hair cut and the new hair person says, oh, what a great haircut.
The last guy did a wonderful job. Your last hairdresser was a genius. Never happens.
I know.
You know, I don't have much hair, so that's not my primary problem. But it's going to happen 100% of the time, right? That the CTO and or the primary technology person that comes in, they're going to say, yeah, it's a complete caca, right? And it's spaghetti code,
right.
and we're going to rebuild the whole thing.
Right,
and,
but see, here's the cool thing. I knew that before I started.
Yeah,
so where we are,
okay.
It's the perfect time for that person to come in. It's just I wanted to hear it from you of the perspective on it as an investor because you know, to me, I would have loved to have that person by my side from day one. But it was a luxury because I didn't.
And fortunately,
God gifted me with the ability to do a bunch of those things on my own. So I did them, right? Now, am I
awesome.
The best person? No.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right.
But it worked.
Look, startups are a process of sort of, you know, by hook or crook, getting there. And if you have the resourcefulness to get where you are, do not feel in any way, do not feel anything other than this is great. I've gotten it this far, and just think about, you know, what do you do next? At some point, you'll bring the tech in house when it's appropriate and as soon as you can, and you know that person, that technology partner for you. And they don't have to be a co-founder. They can just be, and they don't even have to be, quote, a CTO. I mean, you don't.
Well,
just,
and to me,
don't get
Howard,
away.
It's a bit
just
of a sham. It's a bit of a sham when you've got a company that anybody can go look on sunbiz.org here in Florida and see how long my company's been around. And it's like, okay, technical co-founders joined you 7 years in? Really interesting. I've always wondered about that.
You know, just get what you need. It does not have to be. It's like, don't overly. You know, you don't. If you don't need a co-founder right now, then don't get one. I mean, don't give away the equity for nothing. If you don't need the big time. You know, massive. Architect CTO type. Then don't get it. You know, get the best you can and get what you need. Just get what you need. You know, don't feel like it's got to be part of some grand plan. Just get what you need and take it one step at a time.
I want to touch on a couple of other points in the book, and we probably could have had a whole call about these two things, but you talk about failure, make it your friend.
My favorite topic.
Yeah, so many entrepreneurs are so fearful of failure. And to me, failure has been my greatest teacher. So, like I said, I could have a whole call about this. But talk to me a little bit about make it your friend.
Yeah. You said something that is perhaps the most important thing. The truth is, success is wonderful, but you really don't learn that much from it. You really learn and you grow from failure. And so failure is an integral part of the startup experience. And first of all, I want to dissect the concept of failure just a little bit and kind of splice it into different parts. day-to-day failures are going to come at you, as I say, like a river. They never stop. They're just going to keep coming, right? So if you're not good at dealing with failure, you will fail. Right? There's a lot of paradoxes involved with failure.
Right.
If you can't embrace failure, it's a certainty you're going to fail. It's a certainty. So let's talk about there's the day-to-day failures, and then there's failure of the enterprise, okay? So failure of the enterprise is to be avoided absolutely at all costs, okay? You do not let the enterprise fail. Under no circumstances do you want the enterprise to fail. Never, right? You cannot let that happen, okay? The paradox is, in order to ensure that your enterprise does not fail and your business does not fail, you have to embrace the day-to-day failures. And some are a little bigger than day-to-day. Let's go back to the beginning of our conversation, which is when I talked about how the original business plan almost never worked, which is a sort of a foundational concept to the whole book, The J-Curve. If you don't embrace that reality, and so you could call that a failure. You should call it a failure. It's just like it didn't work, right? We had this idea,
great
widget. Everyone told me they thought they loved it. We created exactly like we said we would. We put it out there, and no one gave a darn. So at that point in time, you can say, no, damn it, I can't let this fail, right? And you can say, I just need more marketing money, and I just need another salesman. And darn it, it's just, we're not getting the word out, and, all these other, crazy things, right? And so the proper response is, we put it out there, and it's a failure, And it's like you got to scream that out loud. It ain't working. It's a failure. And you got to get the whole team together and say, it ain't working. It's a failure. And that is what I call embracing failure, right? You're just looking at the data, and it's pretty goddamn obvious. It's just not going to work. And so that is what I call embracing failure. If you fight failure and if you refuse that particular failure, you're going to fail. Because you're going to torch whatever remains of your money. Your team is just going to get increasingly depressed, and eventually it collapses. And so what I like to see is people are just like, what's required is intellectual honesty. And intellectual honesty just means that you know damn well it's a problem, and you're not fooling yourself, and you deal with it. By embracing failure, you're dealing with these failures before they become catastrophic. And so I think if people really, and this is certainly one of the great hopes of my book in terms of, from my perspective, getting the word out. I want people to have this conversation. I want people to look at it and understand the different types of failure. The day-to-day failures, they're going to happen. We're human beings. It's just going to go down, and stuff's not going to work as expected. And if you embrace that, and if you say, yeah, it ain't working, what are we going to – then you can get to, of course, the most important part, which is what on earth are we going to do to fix it? And you know what? There's always a play. There's always, always, always a play. But you can't get to that play unless you embrace failure. So that's my that's my concept of failure and the different types of failure and how to deal with failure. And if you really figure that out as an entrepreneur, God, it's going to save you so much time, and it is going to get you to success so much faster. And as I say, that it's all a paradox.
Absolutely.
Kind of a fun one.
Well, at the risk of ending on the topic of failure, I do want to be mindful of time because I told you we would wrap up at 1 o'clock. And
the failure, embracing failure is just to get to success. So let's talk about success. It's just you're going to get to success faster, and that's what all this honest conversation is about. It's just getting you to success.
Right. And, the one topic I had wanted to spend some time on, but perhaps it's for another day, is. One of the things that you do touch on in this book is the personal side of startup life, and I've got a very long story about that, which I will not tell on this particular show, but you can't underestimate the impact on family and relationships and personal finances, and it is a commitment, and you do have to go in knowing that you put a lot at risk.
Yes, I mean startups are risky, no question about it. But look, in the end, nothing's more important than your health, and nothing's more important than your family, and somehow I know it's so hard to keep it all in perspective, and that's one of the struggles. But there's a whole chapter about it in the book that hopefully will provide a lot of advice and perspective on it.
Well, again, we have been talking today to Howard Love. The book title is The Startup J-Curve, The 6 Steps to Entrepreneurial Success. Howard, if folks would like to follow you, learn more about you, buy the book, how do they find you?
First of all, go to howardlove.com. There's more information about the book. There's a really cool we're just putting up today the what I call the perfect pitch deck, which is sort of a pitch deck template for raising money, and there's other kinds of tools on there. And there's links to many of the great stores that are carrying the book. They're going to be carrying the book. It's going to be released in about August 30th. Possibly a little bit before. You can pre-order now. And there's just lots of great stores carrying us, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Books, Inc., and 1-800-CEO-Reads and others. And come to howardlove.com. I have a blog there and other things going on. You can also follow me on Twitter, @HowardLove. And, thanks so much again for having me today, Chick.
My pleasure. It has just been it was personally fascinating for me just because of where I am in my latest journey. But I am going to sit down with the book this weekend, pen in hand, and I'm going to write my notes in the margin, and then I'll probably call you and ask you some more questions.
Cool.
But
it has been
fascinating, Howard. I really appreciate your time. And again, if you're an entrepreneur and you want to change your game, then I highly recommend that you get this book. If you'd like to learn more about the Game Changer Network, please go to thegamechanger.network, and you can listen to a number of our other shows. We've got close to 300 shows that we have done on entrepreneurialism and growth and leadership and all of the other components of moving your business ahead. So thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to The Game Changer. Ideas, inspiration, innovation with Chickie Fitzgerald.